Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for coming to hang out with me this hour on Speak Up at CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Before we get going, I want to acknowledge that we broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Kwikwetlem, the Musqueam, the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and other Coast Salish peoples, the homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. Today is Thursday, February 22nd, and today on the show, got a piece from the archives, an interview by CJSF's Obadiah Darrell Jones with Black author Wade Compton. There's an interview and then a recording of a reading back from 2015. Wade Compton reading from his work, The Outer Harbor, which is a collection of short stories. And a little bit more, but that is going to take up most of the hour. So I want to get us going into our Thursday morning tradition and give you a little bit of local music. This time, I'm very pleased to be able to bring you some music by a CJSF alumna, Hallelujah Hailu, who came to CJSF as part of the ACET program with Burnaby Secondary Schools. Got to come make a radio show here, learn how to do radio stuff with a number of her classmates, some of whom have continued to produce creative projects with her. And she has a new video and song out that we're going to hear right now. It is called Manic Pixie Pacifist, right here on CJSF.
Don't call me and expect anything other than my usual apathetic tone. I'm not a cop, I'm not a priest, but you confess it all to me. Who else knows? Maybe I'm just a manic pixie pacifist. Act real, the life that you've been living in. Just a step in a character development. Was I just playing a role and you were taking me home? We took the day to crawl the bay. I told you I'm afraid to change you went away. I pity the version of me who carved our name into that tree. Was I just playing a role?
Pixie Pacifist by Hallelujah Hailu, the new track, new video. You can watch that on YouTube. CGSF alum, always happy to rep one of our own. If you want to get involved and become a CGSF volunteer and eventually alum, I guess, if you graduate, you can by emailing our volunteer coordinator, Juju, at VOL4CJSF@SFU.ca, VOL4CJSF@SFU.ca, or you can come by the station Monday to Friday, 10 to 5. We're in the basement of the Student Union building up on SFU's Burnaby campus. Okay, now we are going to get into Obadiah's interview and then recording of a reading with / by Wade Compton from 2015. Here we go.
My name is Obadiah Jones Darrell, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing the Vancouver writer, Wade Compton.
What inspired you to get involved in doing your art form?
I always loved to read as a kid. But I read strangely. Like, I read really weird books. Like, I would read the dictionary. I would read encyclopedias. I think because my dad brought home an old Funkin' Wagnalls encyclopedia set that he found in an alley or something like that. It was incomplete. Yeah, that kind of thing. And I remember reading that and just reading the entries over and over again. Which I think is why today I'll read Wikipedia, I'll surf Wikipedia, I'll hit random and read random articles, random things, which I think is because of that imprinted early on, this idea that it was interesting to just read things that were completely new. I don't know why writing was something that that came to me. What it ended up being, though, is how I filtered the world and how I tried to understand things and tried to analyze the experiences of my life. Like, that's what writing became. It was a space for me to sort out what was happening and what was happening to me. And I think you can do that through anything. Like, I think, you know, I see my daughter doing it through art, through visual art, quite a lot, right? Kids are really good with that. Representing the world or working on problems through drawing things or painting them and that sort of thing. For whatever reason, for me, it was through writing. And but it's such a different world now. There's so many different types of media that young people can use anything. And now it would be exciting to have access to all the different forms that people can use now.
Can you remember a time that inspired you to want to get involved in community activities?
That's a good question. I think the moment I would trace it back to would be reading the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was in high school, maybe just the year after high school. I forget, I can't remember. But when I was 18 or 19, around that age, and maybe a little bit before that, it was listening to the Public Enemy album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And where Malcolm X is mentioned, I probably read the autobiography because it was mentioned on Public Enemy's album. But I remember, I remember listening to that record and just being floored, like just thinking, what is this? Like, you know, sonically, but also the politics, and just trying to understand. It seemed like it just seemed like such a smart and vibrant critique of things that I'd never heard before. And then I encountered on a friend's mother's bookshelf the autobiography of Malcolm X and asked if I could borrow it. She said sure, and then I read it, and that just turned me around, and I was just going, oh my god, this answers so many things that I had experienced or thought about but had no words for. And I mean, that's what Malcolm was great for. I think he put so many people's feelings into words, and you could hear an echo of what you'd felt but not really been able to articulate. And there's such a power in that. Being able to articulate experience is so powerful, because you, in a way, if you can't, you just circle around within it. I feel like if things are happening to you and you don't know how to explain it, then you'll repeat patterns and just, you know, it'll just spin around. You can take control of this. You can take control of how you view yourself. Or those things were just like a revelation to me. What's amazing about it is he did it all with words, you know, with oratory, all with words.
Oh, that's powerful.
Yeah.
You mentioned like the autobiography of Malcolm X. Are there any other books that were really important for you as you were developing to what you are today?
From reading that book to reading about the Black Panther Party and just reading about Black Power and all of that, and then getting involved in kind of left-wing politics in Vancouver, but then also doing an English degree at the same time as all of this. And so trying to fit those two things together, which didn't automatically come together for me. I mean, I had yet to figure out how my writing was connected with these political ideas and how this fit. Another revelation was reading George Eliot Clarke's Saltwater Spirituals and Deeper Blues. I've read it here in this library we're in right now for the very first time in the 90s. It would have been the early 90s at some point when I was doing my undergrad degree. It wasn't in a class. Nobody was teaching it. I don't know how I found it. I stumbled across it somehow. I don't even remember how exactly, if someone had mentioned it to me, or I used to just wander around the stacks looking for interesting books. But reading that, it blew my mind, because I realized, I was reading a lot of poetry and reading literature, but it was Canadian and it was Black and it was regional. And even though it may seem, you know, Nova Scotia is the other side of the country, it's very, very far away. But to me, it felt familiar in that it was not Central Canada, you know? So it felt like, it's hard to explain, but I felt like, well, that's on the other end of the country and we're on this end of the country. We're kind of similar in some ways in that we're not in the center. We're not in Toronto. And not where much music is, or where all of, you know, where the voice of the country is from. And so it just made writing seem possible, made creative writing seem possible for me in a way that reconciled those political things I was talking about with poetry. And I just thought, wow, man, and so my first book in a lot of ways was me trying to figure out if I could do what he did, but here in BC. You know, it was me trying to answer that, kind of go, is this possible? Is there a way I can do something similar in such a different place? Because then you quickly realize the conditions here are so different. The history is so much more recent, for one, and the numbers are smaller. In a place like Vancouver, and, you know, everything is different. So then it sort of took its course.
Because I don't know if you know, I'm a seventh generation African Nova Scotian.
I did know that. Well. Yes.
And George Eliot Clarke was my mother was his teacher when he was in high school.
I didn't know that.
Can you think of any other Canadian authors that were also important that you were able to read?
Well, Dion Brand.
Okay.
It was very big for me in a very different way. They're very different styles, Dion Brand and George Eliot Clarke, but her poetry always seems so exciting and incisive and thoughtful and political. And so, but also her prose, like the book Map to the Door of No Return. This is such an amazing book. It's just an example of prose that is poetic. It's nonfiction, but it's like poetry as well. And just her, just the clarity of thought that comes from her. So she's someone I always read and keep track of. And then I was looking at Black British Columbian writers for my thesis, which became an anthology that I did. So looking at the writers here was very important too. And again, for imagining, you know, writing about these subjects here.
Wade Compton, reading from his newest book, The Oder Harbor.
Gene has seen it. It's been there above those waves for a year and a half now. It's a natural miracle for the way it rose up out of the sea, burning and sending skyward a fountain of dry ash from the mouth of the inlet. But the island is nothing personal until the morning she is reading the sun and drinking tea, and Fletcher, her roommate, tosses an essay on top of the paper, blotting out its field of words with his. Look, he says. The pages are warm and smell like toner, freshly poured forth from Fletcher's printer. He sits down and stares at her. She realizes he is waiting for her to read it right now. The essay is a solid block of geological jargon, and after two paragraphs, she stops and skims. When even her skimming mires, she looks up at him and asks, "Why are you showing me this?" "I want to go there," Fletcher says. "Where?" "There." Jean looks at the essay. "They've turned it into a protected zone, a national site for research," she points out. "Nobody can go there but scientists." "Indian land," he says. "Brand new land. Brand new colonization." Fletcher makes a gesture toward the kitchen window. He says, "It's worth some kind of intervention, occupation. Throw a monkey wrench in the data collection. Get in on the anti-colonial ground floor, like." She looks back at the essay. "Hyaloclastite breccia, opaque petrology, co-ignimbrite plumes." The language sits there and stares back. The language of dirt, 100 fancy words for dirt, flaming dirt rising up out of the dirt, spewing a mist of dirt all over the settled dirt. It is impossible for her not to think of the Bible, impossible for her not to think of clay, impossible for her not to think of a few huffs of breath and how that's us. Impossible for her not to think of how colonized her thinking is, ground floor to glass ceiling. Fletcher is from Victoria, was adopted by whites, had a Snohomish mother from the U.S., and a local father from a band unknown to Fletcher or anyone else who might tell him. He's never met any of his blood relatives. Jean, on the other hand, is pretty much black. At the first meeting, a copy of a book called Surtsey, Iceland's Newest Island, with a photograph of an erupting volcano on the front, sits in the middle of the coffee table. Jean focuses on it during the planning. "I'm not native," Jean says, planting her non sequitur in the air. Everyone turns to look at her, but nobody says anything. "I don't know if I should be here," she says. "I mean, I figure I should say that right now. Should I be here?" Fletcher rolls his eyes. "Let me get this straight," Rob says to Fletcher, ignoring Jean. "You want us to get in a little inflatable boat and go out to an active volcano in the middle of the Saltchuk? The French did it. There." Fletcher points at the book. "Journalists put a dinghy on that just a few days after it emerged, while it was still exploding on the other side. Then they claimed the island, half joking, completely pissed off Iceland. But the cone on ours is barely active now. It's very doable." Allison says, "Should we do it, though?" Jean stares at Mark's uncrossed arms. He has a tattoo on the inside of his left forearm. Mark told her that he inked the image himself. The outline of a wing, raggedly drawn. Blue-green, free-handed. She imagines the pose required to hold a needle with one hand and draw steadily upon your own arm. To hold yourself in front of yourself like you would cradle a clipboard. She realizes the shaking evident in the image is the pain that looped between the art of one arm and the mark-making other. Fletcher, Jean, and Rob study all they can of the island, books and news articles. They fill their home with words about that half-kilometer hill of ash just this side of the line between the Strait of Georgia and the Burrard Inlet. Fletcher muses that they are studying the history of the place, a country with a less than two-year timeline. Its ancient past was under the ocean, Fletcher muses, under the ocean floor even, sloshing around in the core of the earth. A midden of magma, he says. They know that earlier, when Pauline Johnson Island first bubbled up out of the water, West Vancouver, often in the path of the prevailing winds, was carpeted with hot ash, and whole neighborhoods had to be evacuated. A day later, when the winds shifted, the same happened to Point Grey. Then Bowen Island got its turn. There was no telling at first how large the volcano would get or how long it would continue erupting. Volcanologists observed it at careful distances as it blasted ejecta into the sky. Parliament declared the island a restricted ecological reserve and named it after the Mohawk poet who had chosen Vancouver as her adopted home. "When the island coughs up its vapors," Fletcher jokingly says to Rob and Jean, "it is speaking Mohawk." After its first harrowing weeks above sea level, the volcano settled to a simmer. It is still technically erupting, but now only produces a slow series of wispy gray exhalations. The residents of the shores of the strait and the outer harbor cautiously returned, swept up, shoveled away the thick layer of tephra that coated everything they owned, and carried on. The little island is droplet-like. Its shape seems strangely unnatural, as if it had been designed rather than born. But scientists point out that tidal erosion will quickly re-sculpt its shorelines. Barring future eruptions, erosion might destroy the island altogether in a matter of years, they say. Nevertheless, the surface is already showing signs of plant and animal colonization. Their word is already becoming a part of the living systems of the coast. Sooner or later, Fletcher says, a pop can will wash up on its shores and it will be officially globalized. On the grid, he says. They're neither scientists, nor sailors, nor strategists, just students. But they borrow a Zodiac and buy a flare gun. For Jean, there is within this crazy plan a kind of retort to the Vancouver she has known. The school teacher whom she loved, who one day out of nowhere called her a gollywog. All the where are you froms, and all the where are you really froms. Being looked at or looked through, depending, but being summed up, appraised, preemptively estranged. The plan they had was not books, not theories, but action, risk, transmutation, a half-suicidal whirlwind, something worth eruption, something to capsize for. Fletcher, beyond the mundane planning, seems inordinately obsessed with the technical composition of the island. He's learning the jargon, acquiring the lingo. Jean gets about half of what he's saying when he speaks the language of palagonitization and wind drift, alocthons and fairy wash. Fletcher almost preaches the Latin and Greek words, the science words, from the pages of the books he's borrowed from the library, reading aloud to Jean and Rob. Fletcher is high on geology. But there's also the moment he's on the porch with her, night, wind, rain, the herbal tea he clings to, and he says, words have to live outside as much as in, I think, like children. If all your words are inside, their meanings will only go so far. Words need air and weather to make things develop. The language nevertheless makes its way into Jean's dreams, which are more and more about Pauline Johnson Island. In these dreams, she transforms into some class of life in the island's ecological succession. She is seagrass. She is bracken fern. She is thimbleberry. She's a starfish rotating in the untouched shallows, near but not of the rippled land, circling around and around it. At first, to her, as she and Fletcher and Rob and Allison and Mark plan, the beasts are only beasts and the plants are only plants. But now they are flora and fauna, a chain of creatures spreading north and south and east and west from all shores. A dandelion seed under the feathers of a gull, a pregnant spider in the deep dry knot of a driftwood branch. When Fletcher tells her that they call seeds that drift over on the wind diaspores, she makes him show her the book that says this. She rereads the sentence 5 times over. She can't think of a single person related to her by blood who knows how to swim. They keep a photograph of the island on the refrigerator door, a picture torn out of McLean's. When Allison and Rob are out on the back porch smoking, Dara, their 4-year-old daughter, points at it and asks Jean, "What's that?" "It's an island in the inlet." "In what?" Jean takes Dara by the hand to the living room, opens the atlas, and shows her. "We're here," Jean says. "It's there." Dara looks at the map and then up at Jean. The child's eyes seem to darken as she thinks. "That's the inlet," Jean says, tracing it with her finger, "and that's the island. It doesn't matter what they call these, though. They're yours, whatever names they use. This new island is yours. You've never had it, but we're going to give it back to you," Jean says. While they're waiting for the summer, Fletcher takes Jean to the Museum of Anthropology at UBC on a fair day. But they don't go in. He takes her behind it, to the site of the old Point Grey Battery, where guns waited for a Japanese invasion that never came 70 years earlier. High ground. They look across the water toward the island, a small gray hump on the surface of the ocean. She sees a wisp of steam marking it like a flag, though the volcano's cone is supposed to be inactive this week. Another day they drive out to Lighthouse Park on the opposite side of the inlet and look from there. They're a little further from the island on this side, but again the antenna of smoke ascending from its center is there. When it's time to go, she looks back and over her shoulder at Point Grey, where they were before. She imagines a resonance, an etch of her presence in the view from the previous week, a spiritual echo from across the body of water, a premature ghost of herself. Fletcher clasps her shoulder and points to the open sea, so she looks. He smiles, his eyes behind his sunglasses, and says to Jean, "That container ship there? It's probably full of fucking televisions. Televisions on the water. Thousands of miles, yeah? You'd think teleportation machines existed until you really think about a thing like that. They talk about myths. A pile of rectangles on my ocean. That's the real fucking myth." Jean watches the ship crawl across the flat blue until she sees what Fletcher sees. They wait for summer, for a long stretch of easy weather and warmth, watery calm. Fletcher is studying boating books, but he doesn't think it will be necessary to do a practice run. The presence of the island has killed a lot of the shipping traffic, so he thinks it'll be simple. Rob likes to break the tension by messing with him, calling him Skipper, or sometimes just Skip. When they're arguing, they call him Captain Vancouver. Sometimes they even call him Captain Bly. Most of the arguing is over the communique. At one meeting, Fletcher presents a long essay to the group, which he calls a draft, and he invites their intervention. But when the four of them start picking apart what he has written, correcting phrases and altering the wording, Fletcher shouts until he gets his way. Nevertheless, in the next meeting, he's entered the changes, giving them each a copy of the document titled Liberation of the New Pan-Indigenous Territory. Jean turns the word symmetry over and over in her mind until it sounds wrong, made up, fabricated. Symmetry, starfish, symmetry, sand dollars, symmetry, asymmetrical resistance. Fractals of body made out of bodies and carrying forth the bodies of the past. She can't tell whether or not they are together. They're planning and spending a lot of time with each other, but she's not sure what all it is, what more it might be. Fletcher was bounced around a lot as a kid, Allison says when Jean asks. House to house, foster homes. I know a bit about that myself. There's a quiet part to him. I don't know what's there. Dara interrupts, asks if she can be taken to the park. Allison tells her to go out and put her shoes on, and the kid sprints for the front hall. Whatever it is you're going to get from him, Allison says, you're probably getting it now. Jean's feelings hover. 3 months later in the summer, on the Zodiac, with Fletcher at the helm, on the sun-glazed water, Jean feels the first real rush of panic. They're navigating out of False Creek with a hull full of minimal gear, a flat of bottled water, the rolled-up banner, a canary-yellow Grundig hand-crank radio. She doesn't fear the police, to whom they'll eventually surrender, as much as she does the ocean, now that they're actually skipping across its mask-like surface. Rob and Allison are sitting together in the middle of the boat, shouting through the noise of the motor at each other. Mark sits back with the gear, lounging in his seat with his shirt off, as if he's on vacation. Jean catches Allison's eyes. Her fear, she's sure, is apparent. Allison breaks off her argument with Rob. "We were just arguing about a spelling mistake," Allison says. "A typo, that's all." Allison holds up her phone, the only one they brought, and she says, "I just sent the communique off. It's done. We'll be there soon. Relax." Jean nods and picks up the yellow shortwave, hugs it to her chest like it could be eased. The low slope on the horizon is there, but the thin tower of smoke that plumes upward and leans slightly in their direction is what finally holds their attention. The sight quiets them all. The island's emanations are minimal and have remained unchanged for quite some time. But still, the suggestion of fire causes them to turn mentally inward. What's the correct verb, she wonders? Land? Beach? Disembark? Whatever it is they'll do, she thinks, they'll do it on a